Welcome to Ekhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhotra AI. Today, we're diving deep into Arundhati Roy's incredible debut novel, The God of Small Things. It came out back in 1997.
It really is one of those books, isn't it? It manages to be this incredibly intimate family story, but also, well, a really fierce political commentary.
Yeah, and Roy herself, for anyone who doesn't know, she came from this unique background, right? Trained as an architect.
That's right. And then bursts onto the literary scene, wins the Booker Prize with this first novel. Instant global recognition, really.
And it's interesting that architectural background, you almost feel it in the way the book is constructed.
How do you mean?
Well, it's built with such careful layering, almost like a blueprint, you know, precise.
Right. I see that.
But the subject matter is all about decay, things falling apart. So you can look at it as, well, a post-colonial critique, definitely a tragedy, but maybe most importantly, it asks this question about the human cost, the cost of breaking society's rules.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And our goal today, I think, is to really peel back those layers. The story set in Kerala, very lush, very humid.
Sticky.
Yes, sticky. And we need to understand the mechanics of the tragedy there. It's about these small personal acts of love running headfirst into the, well, the big things history cast power.
Okay, let's start with that setting then. I am in Kerala. You mentioned the landscape. It's almost like a character itself.
It really is. Lush, but also decaying. Just like the family at the center of it, the Syrian Christianite family.
And their failing pickle factory, paradise pickles and preserves, it's all sort of fading.
Exactly. And Roy uses this non-linear timeline, which is just crucial. The narrative jumps back and forth.
Between when?
Between two really intense weeks in December 1969. When the main tragedy unfolds, and in the aftermath 24 years later in 1993.
Ah, okay. So you see the consequences before you fully grasp the cause.
Precisely. It creates this sense of inevitability, like doom hanging over everything right from the start.
And if that doom is the atmosphere, then the engine driving it all is what Roy calls the love laws. That phrase itself is so chilling.
It is, isn't it? These aren't written laws, you understand. They're the brutal, unspoken codes.
The ones that dictate everything.
Everything. As the book says, they're the laws that lay down who should be loved and how much. They enforce caste, class, religion, violently.
So the core conflict, the tragedy, it stems from someone daring to love across those lines.
Exactly. A forbidden love affair challenges that whole rigid structure. It's not just personal. It becomes, in essence, a political act. A dangerous one.
Right. So to understand just how dangerous, we need to look at the people involved. Starting with the heart of the novel, maybe? The twins, Vesta and Rahel.
Yes, the dual protagonists. When we first meet them properly in 1969, they're 7 years old.
And they have this incredible bond, almost telepathic.
It feels that way. Roy describes them as like a single unit. They even have their own private language, sort of shutting out the messy adult world.
But that bond, it gets shattered, doesn't it?
Completely shattered by the events of 69. It's a story of profound loss of innocence. Esta, maybe the more fragile of the two, he gets returned to his father after the trauma.
Sent away.
Yes. And this separation, this trauma, it silences him. He retreats into this deep protective silence for decades.
Wow. And Rahel?
Rahel grows up restless.
Yeah.
A drifter, really. Can't seem to form connections. Always haunted by what happened.
So when they reunite as adults in 1993, back in that decaying house, it's not exactly a happy reunion.
No, not at all. It's more like this quiet, desperate search for understanding, solace, trying to find the only other person who truly knows what was lost.
And the center of that loss, the catalyst for it all, is their mother, Amu, and her relationship with Falutha.
Yes. Amu is such a tragic figure. She's come back home after a divorce, which in that society puts her in a position of shame, dependency.
But she's not passive, is she? She's intelligent, passionate.
Oh, very passionate. And volatile. She chafes against the restrictions placed on her. Her affair with Falutha. The book calls it a doomed grasp for happiness.
That says it all. And Falutha, he's the god of small things from the title. What does that mean?
Well, he's a carpenter, incredibly skilled with his hands. A good man. But crucially, he's from the Paravan caste Dalit, historically untouchable. So he represents the beauty in simple, tangible things. Small joys, kindness, the things the big world overlooks or crushes.
So for Amu, from her Syrian Christian higher caste background, to love Falutha, it's not just breaking a rule, it's like attacking the whole foundation of their society.
Exactly. It's a fundamental challenge to the love laws. Purity, hierarchy, everything the family, especially the older generation, clings to. So that love has to be punished, neutralized.
And the person who takes charge of that neutralization is Baby Kuchama, the grand aunt.
Yes. If Amu is tragic passion, Baby Kuchama is, well, she's bitterness personified. Cold, calculating.
What drives her? It's not just about upholding tradition, is it?
No, it's deeply personal. Her whole life is warped by this unrequited love she had for an Irish priest years ago. She couldn't get the lover status she wanted.
So she channels that frustration outward.
Into control. Malicious control, clinging desperately to social standing. When she finds out about Amu and Velutha, it's not just disapproval. She sees an opportunity. She becomes the instrument of society's punishment.
Right. Okay, so we have the players, the setting, the rules, the love laws. Now let's trace how it all falls apart. The plot.
It's like a terrible chain reaction, isn't it? Starting in 1969, there's this tension building because Chaco's English ex-wife, Margaret, and their daughter, Sophie Moll, are visiting from England.
Sophie Moll. Her arrival is a big deal.
Huge. It really exposes the family's colonial hangover, their obsession with anything English while looking down on their own people. It's deeply hypocritical.
And meanwhile, Amu and Velutha are meeting secretly.
By the river, the Menashal River. Their bond deepens, but it's always under the shadow of discovery.
Then comes the turning point. The trip to the cinema.
Yes. A really fraught outing. Esta is molested by this vendor, the orange drink, lemon drink man. It's horrifying.
And Emma's reaction.
Amu is trapped, terrified about her own situation with Velutha, maybe feeling the walls closing in. She lashes out at the twins, calls them millstones around her neck. A moment of pure desperation on her part.
With devastating for the children.
Absolutely devastating. They feel rejected, unwanted. They decide to run away.
To find Velutha. They see him as safe.
Yes, he's their image of safety. But to reach him, they try to cross the river, the Menakul, which is swollen with rain, and the boat capsizes.
And Sophie Moll.
Sophie Moll drowns. The river, the site of Amu and Velutha's forbidden love, becomes the instrument of death.
A terrible accident, but it doesn't end there. This is where Baby Kuchama steps in.
Maliciously. She sees Sophie Moll's death not just as a tragedy, but as a chance to destroy Amu and Velutha, to cover up the scandal of their affair and protect the family honor.
How does she do it?
She spins this calculated lie. She frames Velutha, accuses him of kidnapping the children, maybe even assault.
And the authorities just believe her.
Instantly. Because of who Velutha is. The police are steeped in caste prejudice. There's no real investigation. They just react based on his caste.
So they hunt him down.
At the History House, his derelict old building, they beat him savagely. He becomes the sacrifice the system demands to restore order. It's brutal.
And the final betrayal involves the twins again.
Yes. Baby Kuchama terrorizes Esta and Rahel, who are already traumatized by Sophie's death and their mother's words. She manipulates 7-year-old Essa.
No.
Forces him to bear false witness against Velutha to confirm the lie. It seals Velutha's fate. He dies in police custody shortly after.
Unbelievable cruelty.
The consequences are just total devastation. Amu is cast out, banished by her family. She dies alone a few years later.
And the twins.
Forcibly separated.
Yeah.
Esta sent away. Rahel left behind. That unique bond they shared as children is just violently severed. Happiness is completely eradicated.
Which brings us back to 1993, the adult reunion in that decaying house.
Yes. And the silence, the unspoken trauma, it finally surfaces. Esta and Rahel are these profoundly damaged, isolated adults.
And Roy includes that final, very difficult scene, their incestuous encounter.
Which is portrayed not sensationally, but as this incredibly sad, desperate act. It's like they're trying to physically merge back into that single unit they once were before the world broke them apart, trying to find some kind of wholeness in the wreckage.
A desperate attempt to heal an unhealable wound.
Exactly. And significantly, the novel doesn't end there. It circles back right at the very end to Amu and Velutha's last moment together by the river, a moment of pure, untainted love before everything was destroyed.
That structure really emphasizes the injustice. Mm. Okay, let's talk about the themes. The title is so important. The God of Small Things. How does that play out?
Well, the world of Iemanjem and perhaps society at large is dominated by the big things, right? Caste, history with a capital H, religion, patriarchy, these huge impersonal forces.
And Velutha.
Velutha embodies the small things. Skill, kindness, nature, the tangible joys of life. He's the God of those things. And the tragedy is that the big things cannot tolerate the small things. They have to crush them.
So his death is almost ritualistic.
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
A sacrifice to preserve the corrupt hierarchy. The novel is a powerful indictment of the caste system, showing the violence needed to maintain those boundaries.
And the hypocrisy involved is staggering. You mentioned Chaco, Amu's brother.
Right. He's upper caste, educated in Oxford. He has casual affairs with lower caste women working at the factory, calls it his man's needs.
And faces zero consequences.
None. But Amu, for one genuine act of love that crosses the lines, she's utterly destroyed. Banished, erased.
It's a brutal double standard, a clear critique of patriarchy woven into the caste critique.
Absolutely. And then there's the theme of lost innocence, shown so painfully through the twins, Hestia's silence. It's perhaps the most powerful symbol of how adult cruelty, hypocrisy, and violence just decimate a child's world.
Their imaginative universe, crushed. It shows how deeply adult actions and silences scar children.
Definitely. And we have to mention Roy's style. The language itself is innovative.
It's beautiful lyrical prose, but it's also unconventional.
Very. She deliberately breaks grammatical rules sometimes. Coins, words, plays with capitalization like orange drink, lemon drink man.
Why does she do that, do you think?
I think it immerses you directly into the children's perspective. Their subjective reality, how they perceive the world. It blurs the line between external events and internal feeling, trauma.
It creates a very specific atmosphere. Almost dreamlike, or maybe nightmarish sometimes.
Yes, and she uses symbolism so effectively, too. Like Papachi's moth.
The moth that haunts the family home, what does it represent?
It seems to represent this lingering dread, unseen threats, maybe the weight of the past, abusive legacies that keep fluttering around them.
And the Menashal River.
The river is everything. It's the site of life, love, passion, Emu, and Volutha's secret place. But it's also the agent of death and destruction when Sophie Mole drowns. That duality is key.
It feels like the non-linear structure is central to the novel's power, too. You're constantly aware of the tragic end, even as you see the moments of happiness.
Exactly. Memory and trauma, they don't follow a straight line, do they? By showing us the consequences early, Roy forces us to see how the structure of that society demanded this outcome. It wasn't just fate. It was the system.
And sadly, those kinds of rigid social structures, those prejudices, they haven't vanished. The novel really challenges us, I think, to see the humanity in everyone, especially those society tries to silence or make invisible. It shows how even the smallest acts of love carry immense weight.
It truly does. It makes you think about the power of those small things in a world obsessed with the big ones. Can love, even when doomed, be a form of resistance?
A profound question to leave us with. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.